You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of CEO Perspectives, a new podcast series by the Conference Board. CEO Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, data-driven look at a range of timely topics that matter most to business executives. To help make sense of these topics and how they'll unfold, we'll sit down with thought leaders and do what we do best at the Conference Board, provide insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this podcast series. Today's conversation will cover the fundamental differences between capitalism and socialism and how each of them is faring in today's political and cultural landscape. And I can't think of anyone better to help me out to size up these two economic systems than Maria Sastre and Lori Esposito Murray. Our devout podcast fans know Lori, who has been a guest many times on the show. She's the president of the Conference Board's Public Policy Center, which is the Committee for Economic Development. And Maria Sastre is the former president and CEO of Signature Flight Support Corporation, long career in the travel industry, and she's a trustee both of the Conference Board and CED, and she's been a board director on many, many public company boards. Welcome to both of you, Maria and Lori.
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Maria, let's start off with you because you have a really interesting family and personal story that relates to our conversation today about socialism.
Thank you, Steve. It's a very moving story. My family is originally from Cuba. And in fact, I was born in Havana in the 50s. My father's family was in the printing business in Havana. And it was a very successful business. It had been in the family for many, many years. My mother's family was from the western part of Cuba, which is a province known as Pinar del Río, from a small town in the heart of tobacco country named San Juan y Martinez. My mother's family, her grandmother, her name was Margarita Martinez, and the town was founded by her family. Tobacco farming was in their family since the mid-1800s to late 1800s. Having said that, both of my parents grew up in Havana, where they met and married, and initially came to the United States at the behest of my paternal grandfather, who owned the printing company I mentioned. He was the patriarch of the family. He was a realist, and he was very, very worried about the political climate that was evolving in Cuba. He was more worried about my father's engagement in that climate. My father was in his early 20s at the time. It's worth noting for the audience that during the 1950s, Cuba was the most prosperous country in the Caribbean and in most of Latin America. It had a very thriving economy rooted in capitalism and entrepreneurship, and it was one of the most literate and highly educated populations in the Western Hemisphere. It did have a three-class social system with an evolving middle class. Many American corporations at the time had businesses in Cuba that were thriving, such as Coca-Cola, Woolworths, Colgate-Palmolive, Starwood Hotels, Exxon, among many. Cuba was used as a laboratory to launch new products. So as an example, black and white TVs were initially launched in Cuba. And that's a little known fact, but a true fact. During the 1950s, Cuba experienced a very, very aggressive social and cultural unrest environment. Ultimately, it was an attack on successful families, an attack on capitalism, an attack on entrepreneurship. They became the target of charming and eloquent revolutionaries, specifically Fidel Castro. The revolutionary movement seized its opportunity by promising all citizens greater social justice, equity for all, and a commitment of transfer of wealth. Some common themes that we listened to most recently in our country. My family lost everything during this revolution. And except for my two grandfathers, my family was able to exile in the United States. My paternal grandfather was hopeful he would recover his business, and he did not want to leave Cuba until that happened. My maternal grandfather was a lifelong civil servant for his country, and he did not believe that he would be affected by the revolution in any way. They both felt that this revolution was transitory. I would say to you today that those were fateful decisions for our family, as we would never see them again. As such, what you see today, 60 years later, across Cuba, is an unattainable society in terms of communist policy. It's been formulated primarily by an unsuccessful social promise and experiment, a very repressive society that does not have an opportunity to grant dissent, a collapsed and austerity-based economy, as you can all see when you see visuals of the Cuba today, which looks like a degraded island and a poor population, a struggling population that's been under a totalitarian dictatorship now for almost 60 years. The fact that Cubans, my fellow Cubans, are still trying to escape from Cuba any way that they can and have recently been emboldened to protest for liberty speaks to the fundamental disaster that socialism has caused Cuba for its citizens.
Yeah, Maria, this is an incredible story, and it's incredibly moving. And I'm sure it moves you every time you tell it. And, you know, we could go on and really spend the whole discussion on Cuba. But I think the important point here for the remainder of our conversation is the similarity between what happened in Cuba and what is now going on today. And you've pointed this out many times to, in meetings and to us at the conference board, that Cuba was the most advanced Western economy, that it was the richest economy. It was, which is really the way the United States would be described today. And yet, in a very short period of time with the social experiment, you know, people wanting to go into, all of the socialist schemes, it took it from the best to the worst almost, and it just totally destroyed many families, and it destroyed the wealth and everything that made Cuba great at the time. And I think these lessons are really important today. And it brings us, Lori, to, the question of, what is socialism? I mean, what is capitalism? What is socialism? Because we talk about this, and you do surveys and you do polls, and we have Congress people who say they're socialists now. But what does it mean? What are the key differences between the two systems?
Thanks, Stephen and Maria. Thank you so much for sharing your family's story, because it's so important today, since so many young people, and I'm including millennials in that young people group, don't really understand the history of this battle royal between capitalism and socialism. What Cuba experienced in the 1950s was really what was unleashed at the beginning of the 20th century, and with Marxist-Leninism as a supposedly a solution to capitalism, and we all know how that ended. But to get to your question, Steve, what is capitalism? Capitalism and socialism are diametrically opposed in terms of how they approach the foundational principles of an economic system. So capitalism is based on free markets. What was originally called the invisible hand is the free markets that drive the efficient use of resources. Production and its organization, labor is voluntary. Capital is in private hands. And production is coordinated in a decentralized way and motivated by profit. So the values that the system is based on are competition, innovation, and freedom of the individual. Just socialism, as Maria was describing, it's a diametrically opposed political and economic system. Property and the means of production are owned in common, typically controlled by the state or the government. But it's important to point out that there are different forms of socialism in terms of understanding today, and they range from democratic socialism, which is popularly assigned in terms of the discussion today in the United States as what European and Nordic countries have. So you have state ownership of some key industries and a progressive tax system to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor. The system in Europe and the Nordic countries today, this form of social, democratic socialism, Karl Marx actually called it, Karl Marx, who was the father of communism, as we all know, called this type of socialism really a transitional social state between the overthrow of capitalism and the realization of communism.
Yeah, so, you know, it's really socialism at its core. But, you know, again, I think there's so much talk of this that I think it's important for our listeners to understand that these are not the same thing and that you can't just simply, you know, notch it back over. You know, we in a capitalist society believe in a safety net. That's not the same as socialism. And socialism is something vastly different. But one way to think about this, Maria, is to say, okay, well, if socialism is so great, which, you know, many of our elected officials now want to create here, who are we emulating? What are the successful economic systems out there that are socialist? What countries have succeeded under socialism?
I can't describe, Steve, a successful socialist country, particularly those that have evolved into hardline communist regimes. I'm not aware of any. You know, I think about Venezuela as our closest and most recent example of tumultuous change into socialism and communist totalitarian regime, even though they profess to have legal elections and democratic elections. We all know what's happened in that country with their election system. So here was another example of one of the most prosperous countries in Latin America, so blessed with natural resources, and today in a complete economic collapse. Cuba, like I mentioned, Bolivia, Nicaragua, all of Eastern Europe, which was part of the USSR structure, evolved away from a socialist structure. So they've been failed social experiments. And it is something that I am very concerned about, because while idealistic, they haven't proven to be sustainable.
Yeah. So the objectives sound great. You know, you have more, you know, social equality, and but that's defined by equality of outcome. And if you're going to do that, then it always seems to devolve to the least common denominator. So it doesn't make people richer. It makes everybody poorer, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Except for the ruling class. And they're, you know, so you talk about the Gini coefficient and, you know, all of these means of measuring inequality. But in socialist countries, the inequality is worse than any capitalist country.
I agree. And, you know, in a capitalist society, what I find amazing, I'm an example of this, right? You can take any opportunity available and you can make a life around that opportunity. You can attain whatever your objective is. It's not easy, by no means. This isn't, you know, a track that's, you know, ready made for any immigrant or any citizen of our country, but it certainly is attainable. And that's the great American story. The great American story are so many people like me and my family who've been able to survive and thrive in this country. And there is no other country in the world that offers such an array of opportunity to so many, many different types of people from so many countries. And the evidence of that is the millions of people that want to immigrate to the United States every year. They don't want to immigrate here because they want socialism. They want freedom. They want the ability to participate in an entrepreneurial capitalist society where they can make a living for their family and thrive, potentially thrive, and create a well-being for generations to come. And so, unfortunately, many people don't understand what we have because they've never seen it anywhere else.
Right. And Lori, you know, the book that came out of CED was Sustaining Capitalism. And you talked about, you know, we talked about in the book the importance of free markets and so forth. Talk a little bit about that, because you talk about lifting people out of poverty and so forth. Capitalism has done that better than any other system.
Well, Steve, that's really the most important point here, that capitalism over the last half century has lifted more people out of poverty faster than ever before. And that's because of the principles that it's based on. And it provides equal opportunity to share in prosperity, as Maria was saying. So, you know, what are the principles it's based on? It's based on efficiency of resources, and it's based on innovation, freedom to pursue and to search for different and better ways to do things based on the efficiency of the allocation of resources. So if you're running a company that isn't successful, it goes away. If it is successful, it continues and leaves space and room for other competitors. What's in the system that Maria was describing in terms of what took over Cuba, and also, of course, you know, looking at the battle royal of the Soviet Union versus the U.S. In terms of different economic systems, you know, where the Soviet Union failed. It was this government control of the economy that really has disrupted the efficient use of resources and the ability for companies that are working well and producing well and producing for consumers well and producing what consumers want to stay alive when they should be dead. And you actually see this also in China. We're looking at China today in terms of the state-owned companies, how, you know, China, you know, since the 1970s has been using market reforms, but they still have this state-controlled of production in a lot of areas, and they're trying to salvage these big companies that are suffer from corruption and trying to use market principles to salvage them. But it's you know, difficult to do that when you have state control.
Right. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about why socialism in the U.S. is gaining ground with our politicians and, you know, particularly among millennials. We'll be right back.
Interested in this content? You can find this and much more at our Conference Board website, www.conference-board.org. Or, even better, contact our membership team and your company can enjoy the benefits of our in-depth research around the economy, environmental, social, and governance issues, public policy, marketing and communications, and human capital. As a member of the Conference Board, you will be able to have full access to all of our cutting-edge research, leading indicators, benchmarking, and data services, in addition to webcasts and podcasts such as the one you are enjoying now.
Welcome back to CEO Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board, and I'm joined by two special guests today, Maria Sastre, the trustee of the Conference Board, and Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray, the president of the Committee for Economic Development. So, Lori, recent polls, especially among millennials, show that more than half of millennials would rather that the U.S. be a socialist nation. Given everything that we've talked about, given Maria's stories, given the fact that there has been no successful socialist nation, what is going on?
So, Steve, the polling data is actually much more interesting if you look at it more closely. But first and foremost, in terms of millennials, you remember that they were born between 1981 and 1996. They missed the Cold War. They missed the collapse of the Soviet Union. They missed this titanic battle between economic systems that capitalism won hands down, and then proceeded to lift so many people out of poverty as China tried to become more of a market economy and other countries around the world, the collapse of Eastern Europe, communist governments, as Maria was pointing out. But looking at the data more closely, actually 55% of millennials view capitalism favorably. You have about 50% viewing socialism positively, but 55% actually view capitalism favorably. And you know, the point here is, as the data suggests, is that the millennials are not clamoring for socialism. And this goes back to the original point I made at the top of the program, which is that they're looking at an idealized version of democratic socialism out of Europe, not even quite understanding it. And they're really looking for an economy that works better and more fairly. And, you know, as I said, when push comes to shove, they like the fact that they can compete. They like the fact that they can do startups. They like the fact that, you know, they could be out there actually innovating in society and much more favorable towards capitalism than the quick brush of polling data would make you believe.
Right. So, you know, but Maria, you know, if every generation has to relive the mistakes of the previous generations, we're destined to just go around in circles here. My own view is that millennials just, they say socialism, but it's really a label for something else. I mean, they just, they want, you know, a fairer society and so forth. But you know, I think they're talking about degrees rather than a wholesale changeover. But the problem is the politicians are saying socialism, in the broadest sense. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think this is at the root of what we have to address. And today in America, I think that I am clearly seeing Marxist ideology, and you see it. It's pervasive in our culture, in our society, the schools, the way press covers certain issues or not. In corporations, unfortunately, you're seeing some of this play out. In elite parts of our society, such as entertainment and media. And unfortunately, in our own Democratic Party, where it's labeled as progressive, but I would challenge it and say it's going to ultimately be regressive. And so this is what, you know, today is termed as democratic socialism. I think part of what we're seeing is this has been going on for decades in terms of rooting this in our education system, the lack of civics training. You know, millennials today are part of a generation where civics was literally wiped out of most scholastic curriculums. They don't fully understand the framework of our constitutional republic and the rights that has given us as its citizens. And so when they see socialism, they see it in this utopian mindset without really understanding the consequences that so many countries have endured. And I also worry that this absence of debate and critical thinking around issues, and that if you don't agree with something, you know, you're ostracized and shut down and taken off of social media or not able to engage in debate, is also a horrible sign of a repressive society. That's what one of the great tenets of American society is, the fact that we have the freedom to express ourselves in whatever opinion we have of issues. So these are issues that are greatly concerning and are at the core of, you know, what I've follow as American Marxism to some degree, and the concerns that I have around, you know, castigating our capitalistic society.
Yeah, Lori, you know, you are an expert in international relations and you've taught at the Naval Academy. You know, you have to wonder a little bit whether all this push on socialism is actually propaganda being deployed by adversaries. Is that just seeing shadows around the corner, or is there some truth to that?
Well, Steve, we know, the intelligence community knows, the American public has been made aware of, you know, there is data that and analysis that actually shows how our social media platforms are being manipulated by our adversaries. That is just a fact. But what's really important here too is what Maria was saying in terms of, you know, what's the responsibility as a society to make sure that we are educating the next generations in terms of understanding capitalism, in terms of understanding democratic institutions? And we really have punted on that responsibility. And civics is a really important foundational educational tool to make sure that we stay strong going forward in terms of our values and realistically assess different competing systems and why we are who we are and how it's working, and also how to improve it. And you mentioned our Sustaining Capitalism book, Steve. The point is that capitalism has adjusted over time, starting in the 19th century when it was the 20th century when it was first challenged by Marxist-Leninism, responding to labor concerns, responding to concerns within the social safety nets that are needed in a society. And it has been adapting and adjusting, which is why it is as strong and viable and sustainable system as it is today.
Yeah, and the Conference Board's been front and center on that. I mean, the Conference Board was formed in 1916 as a vehicle to try to get to standardized labor practices, the 40-hour work, 5-day work week, labor standards, safety standards, and so forth, pay standards to try to improve all that. So, you know, we've been there right along. But Maria, you know, we dabbled with communism and socialism in the 30s, you know, pre-World War II in America. And there was a lot of debate and discussion about it. So are, you know, is this just the pendulum swinging and we're sitting here now in 2021 and it's a short-term blip or, you know, little artifact? Is it just an aberration?
No, I think it's more serious than that. And I think that because it's now evidencing itself in our political landscape, in our media, including social media, in the manner in which we protest, and across many other facets, including the entertainment industry, I think this is very broad. And it's been years in the making. I am very fond of a famous quote by the former president of the Communist Party of Russia, USSR. And it was Nikita Khrushchev. And many, many newer generations don't remember Nikita Khrushchev. But if you can, you should Google him and read some of his famous quotes. And this is actually one of the ones that I think is the most insightful. We cannot expect the Americans to jump from capitalism to communism, but we can assist their elected leaders in giving Americans small doses of socialism until they suddenly awake to find that they now have communism.
Wow.
And this quote, he actually said this in the United Nations in 1960.
Wow. So this has been going on a long time. So Maria,
this has been going on for a long, long time because we've been the envy of so many societies around the world. Our success has been the envy. And so here we are.
Right. So Maria, you've lived this, you know, through your life and, you know, you believe deeply we're on the wrong track here in the U.S. What should business leaders be doing to help people understand the benefits and the beauty of capitalism?
I've always felt in my life and in my associations with my business, the businesses I've been engaged with, I think businesses have to be fiscally responsible to their stakeholders, but socially responsible as well, right? And all in a balance. I think that business leaders need to stop behaving like packs of wolves, you know, trying to align themselves with the political party at play. I think this is not sustainable, and it's actually creating more disruption than we should have in our society. We need to figure out the right balance around critical issues and the truth, and we need to stop chasing rhetoric. And to this issue, I think that business leaders have a responsibility to society as a whole. I think they need to be more courageous, you know, about the truth and about standing up for America. And for, you know, the basic tenets of why we were founded, I find this absent in many leaders today. And I find them just being followers instead of leaders. And that's greatly, greatly concerning.
And your point on them being followers and playing to the party is that they've actually moved left in what they're doing. And
correct.
And that's correct. That's what you mean by that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Lori, what your thoughts on what the business community should be doing to help promote capitalism and evolve capitalism?
Well, Steve, you know, business leaders, you know, they're at the tip of the spear and they're the stewards of capitalism, of market-based economies. And that gives them not only a front and center role in terms of a capitalist economy continuing to churn its engines, but also making capitalism sustainable. And I want to get back to that essential point. So, they have responsibilities to their workforce, their customers. They have responsibility to train their workforce in this dynamic economy that technology is rapidly accelerating the pace of change. They invest profits, and they need to do this in productive ways, and particularly in terms of infrastructure and innovation. They have a short-term approach that needs to be really changed into a longer-term approach as far as instead of just looking at quarterly returns, you know, looking at the long haul for where the companies are going and how they're responding in terms of, you know, what customers are asking for, what employees are asking for. You know, they basically maintain the integrity of the system, making sure it's not crony capitalism, but capitalism based on free markets. So sustainability of capitalism and sustainability in general is a responsibility to the environment really falls on the shoulders of business leadership. But I would also like to add just one more point, because this is the basic principle of the Committee for Economic Development and of the Conference Board, which is that business leaders really need to play an active role in making sure that our public policy is both responsive and responsible, that we're doing what we need to do as a society and as a government in terms of fiscal policy, but we're doing it responsibly and making sure we can pay for it. So we're responding to the needs of society, setting priorities, and making sure we can pay for it. And they have a bringing that rationale into the public square is so absolutely critical.
Wow. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Maria and Lori, thanks so much for joining us today and providing our listeners with a roundup of insights on the perils of socialism and the importance of working to sustain capitalism. And thanks to all of you for listening to CEO Perspectives. Every few weeks, I'll be joined by a leader from one of our centers or one of our member companies to provide insights on the issues of our time. We'll cover leading topics in public policy, environmental, social, and governance, marketing communications, the economy, human capital, and more. Please share CEO Perspectives with your colleagues. I know that they're going to want to listen to it as well. I'm Steve Odland, and this podcast has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You have been listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.